Chapter 4. Beyond Bargaining. A plot to discredit the Buddhists. According to tradition, the Buddha gained enlightenment at the age of 35 and died at the age of 80. He spent the intervening 45 years moving around northern India, teaching people the way to freedom. Over the years, as he continued his tireless teaching, the number of his followers increased manyfold, both wanderers and those living the household life. As we saw in the last chapter, there were at that time many wanderers following different beliefs and teachers. The Buddha's success and the consequent ease with which his wandering followers found help and support from the lay people, not surprisingly, created a certain amount of envy among some of the followers of other teachers. This story concerns such a situation and a conspiracy to ruin the reputation of the Buddha's followers. We are once again in the great town of Sarvati in Kosala, which we visited in Chapter 2. Sarvati is one of the main centres of the Buddha's teaching, and he and his followers are held in high esteem. Indeed, they have the patronage of the king of Kosala, Pasanadi, who is probably the most powerful ruler in India. In addition, the Jetta Grove, a fine park a little way out of the city, has been bought for them by the rich businessman Anathapindika. Many people are appreciative of the Buddha's teaching and are happy to provide him and his followers with everything they need, which, because the Buddhist wanderers are committed to lives of simplicity, is very little: robes and bowl, food, simple lodgings and medicines. The people's enthusiasm for the Buddha's teaching and their appreciation of the conduct of his followers inevitably means that, by contrast, the teachings and practices of other wanderers appear less satisfactory. As a result, wanderers following other teachers receive less respect, and it has become harder for them to find material support. For some of them, this is very difficult to bear, which rather confirms the people's lower estimation of them. The Buddha has tried to prevent other wanderers from suffering as a result of the popularity of his teaching. When he was staying among the Vajjayans, a general called Siya, a leading supporter of the Jains, came to debate with him. The Buddha's teaching so impressed the general that he wished to become his disciple. But the Buddha advised him to consider such a step very carefully, as it would have consequences for the Jains. Eventually, General Siya did become a Buddhist, but still the Buddha encouraged him to continue to support the Jains who were dependent on him. Despite this, some of the other wanderers living in the Sarvati area become disgruntled and resentful of this Buddhist cuckoo in their nest. When they meet together, much of their time is spent in jealous complaints about how the Buddha has spirited away their followers and taken the food out of their alms bowls. Eventually, a small group of them, even more malcontent than the rest, decide on drastic measures to destroy their Buddhist competitor's image. They meet in secret to decide what is to be done and devise a plan. As step one, they go to talk to one of their female companions, called Sundari. Her name means beautiful, and she is an attractive and open-hearted young woman. The group ask Sundari to do them a favour. She is happy to consent, without hearing what the favour is, because she would gladly do anything for her kinsman. However, the favour is quite a simple one. The group simply ask Sundari to regularly visit the park where the Buddhist wanderers are staying. Sundari is happy to do as she is asked. Her friends add one more point. Can she be sure to visit the Jetta Grove in a conspicuous way, so that people notice her doing so? This will not be difficult, as Sundari lives up to her name. Sundari agrees to this condition too, without even asking what it is all about. People soon become used to seeing the attractive young wanderer visiting the Jetta Grove. She is there so often, on one pretext or another, that some even wonder if she is interested in the Buddha's teaching. After a few weeks of this, the group thank Sundari for what she has done. She is happy to have been of service, though she cannot see how what she has done has benefited anyone. The group assure her that she has been of help, and could now do them an even greater favour if she will meet them that evening near the Jatta Grove. Sundari is nervous of wandering around after sunset, so one of the group agrees to accompany her. With her escort, Sundari makes her way to the appointed place with a light heart, happy at the thought that she may be of further service to her fellow wanderers. When they arrive at the rendezvous, three of her kinsmen are waiting. She asks them what further favour she can do for them. In response, her escort suddenly puts his hand over her mouth, and the others advance upon her. Poor Sundari is killed by the fellow wanderers she had been so happy to help. Then, under cover of darkness, a couple of them take her body to the Jatta Grove and bury it in a ditch. The next day, the group seek an audience with Passanadi. They complain to him that Sundari has disappeared, and they are afraid she may have come to harm. The king asks the distressed group if they have any suspicions as to where she might be. They have no idea. Except now they come to think of it, in the weeks before she disappeared, Sundari had taken it into her head to go visiting the Jatta Grove. Perhaps she might be there. The king gives them permission to scour the grove. At this, the wanderers gather together as many people as possible and make their way to their rival's stronghold. The Buddhists are naturally surprised to have such a crowd descend upon them. However, when it is explained that Passanadi has given the group permission to search for their kinswoman, the Buddhists allow them to do so. The group make a great show of searching the grove. After some time, amid a great clamour, they manage to discover poor Sundari's corpse in the ditch. The group make as much capital out of their find as they can. They put the body on a litter and parade it around Sarvati. As they do so, they complain bitterly to everyone they meet, saying, "Look what these followers of Gotama have done. These shameless hypocrites claim to be living pure lives as homeless wanderers, but actually they have abandoned any peace of mind or purity. How could a man, having slept with a woman, kill her in this way?" By this means, they do everything they can to incite the townspeople to indignation. The Buddha's followers, going into Sarvati next morning to beg for food, suddenly find themselves taunted and vilified by people repeating the group's insults and accusations. Having gathered what food is to be had, and from some quarters supplies have completely dried up, the Buddhists return to the Jatta Grove, some of the newer wanderers looking pale and shaken. Naturally, they go to the Buddha and tell him of the abuse they have encountered in the city. The Buddha's response is calm and measured. He predicts that, if it is handled in the right way, the uproar will not last long, that it will subside in a week. Nevertheless, some of his followers are still very anxious. Others are angry at being treated so unjustly. The Buddha urges all of them to reply patiently to the abuse and criticism. He tells them to respond to their accusers by asserting the serious consequences of lying or hiding the truth. In this way, they will put themselves on oath that they have spoken the truth when they deny all knowledge of Sundari's murder. Over the next few days, when the townspeople again abuse them, the Buddhists reply gently in the way taught them by the Buddha. The calm demeanour of the Buddhists and the way in which they have put themselves on oath to tell the truth begins to sway the opinion of the townspeople. They start doubting if the Buddhists are guilty of the crime they were charged with by the other wanderers. Within a week, as the Buddha predicted, his followers meet with no further accusations. Very soon, the former high opinion that many people in Sarvati had of the Buddhists is restored. Some of his followers express their surprise to the Buddha at how quickly the furore has died away. Reflecting on the recent events, he sums up the lesson to be learnt from them in a verse. "Folk unrestrained pierce through a man with words, as an elephant with arrows in a fight. Hearing the utterance of bitter speech, let a monk bear it unperturbed at heart." Taking offence and the reciprocal relationship. What can we draw from this story and the Buddha's advice to his followers? Ringing clearly through it is a strong injunction to practice patience. At Sarvati, the Buddha's followers could have responded with anger and upset at being unjustly accused. They might have started making counter-accusations against the other wanderers. The incident would then have escalated and would certainly not have died away in 7 days. If we follow the news, we shall find that very frequently some group or individual is reported as being very angry at the way they have been treated or at some insensitive remark made about them. Sometimes religious groups feel they are entitled to righteous indignation at some offence which has been offered to their beliefs. From a Buddhist point of view, this whole tendency to anger, righteous indignation, and taking offence is unhelpful and leads to more suffering. The Buddhist ideal is to maintain a positive feeling even for those who are critical or abusive, and to respond objectively to what they say, acknowledging what is true and pointing out what is untrue in a measured way. This story has wider implications. Practicing patience in the face of criticism is one example of a much wider principle which is crucial to the whole quest for freedom. This chapter is entitled Beyond Bargaining, because what this story fundamentally shows is that to become truly free, we need to go beyond what I call the reciprocal relationship. What is this reciprocal relationship? Let us first be clear how I'm using the word reciprocal. It can mean just mutual, but here I mean it in the sense of a relationship in which things are done or not done in return for something else. Suppose I invite you to dinner. You might return the invitation by inviting me to lunch. In this way, you reciprocate. You give me something equivalent to what I have given you. Whilst this can be a perfectly reasonable way to operate, certain kinds of reciprocal relationship are limiting and unhelpful. Let us try to imagine the train of thought of one of the Buddhist followers entering Sarvati who does not manage to follow the Buddha's injunction, who does produce thoughts of ill will towards the townspeople who are abusing him. His internal dialogue probably runs along these lines. Here am I, a wanderer. I've left my home in search of the truth. I am completely blameless of Sundari's murder. I am trying to practice harmlessness and non-violence, love for the world. And what do I get in return? False accusations and abuse. What is going on here? The wanderer's hurt and anger is based upon the idea that there is, or there should be, some kind of reciprocal relationship between the way he acts and how people treat him. But on this occasion, the reciprocal relationship has been broken by the accusing townspeople. The wanderer feels he has done nothing to deserve this treatment, so he feels a righteous or justified anger. The Buddha very clearly disowned this kind of thinking in many of his teachings. Leaving the world of the Manu. We can widen out from this example and the Buddha's condemnation of taking offence to derive a more general principle. Someone following the path to freedom needs to give up thinking in terms of a reciprocal relationship between what they give and what they receive. Looking for a correlation between what you are entitled to and what you should give to others will cause you suffering and block your path, your progress on the path to freedom. You might well question this statement, arguing that reciprocal relationships are fundamental and necessary to the operation of human societies. After all, as a member of society, you are endowed with certain rights and privileges, which are bestowed on you by society, provided you operate within its norms and carry out your duties as a citizen. There is a direct relationship between giving and receiving. Whilst this is true on its own level, it is a framework of thought that is superseded once we enter upon the path to freedom. There is a teaching found in the Tibetan tradition that can help us here. Buddhism has a perspective which encompasses aeons. It sees world systems evolving and then disappearing. A Buddha is the first person to gain enlightenment in a particular era. However, according to this tradition, before a Buddha can appear and teach the Dharma, there must first be a Manu, who helps set up the conditions for a society in which enlightenment can be attained. The Manu is a primordial lawgiver who lays down the principles of justice and fairness for society. Here the tradition uses Manu to cover a type of individual or even an archetype. The Indian Manusmriti, a text which was fundamental in determining how Indian society developed, includes many manifestly unjust laws which discriminated against the so-called untouchables. These laws and principles are essential if society is to cohere at all. All healthy societies are underpinned by concepts of fairness and respect for the rule of law. Nonetheless, necessary as it is, the world of the Manu is clearly founded on reciprocal relationship. When you step on the path to freedom, you move from the sphere of the Manu to that of the Buddha. The latter, though based on the work of the Manu, goes beyond it. The Manu deals with group members, the Buddha with individuals. In the sphere of the Manu, if someone mistreats you or robs you, you are entitled, through the institutions of law, to recover what you have lost and to take a form of institutionalized revenge. The domain of the Manu is based on the maxim, do as you have been done to. The world of the Manu in the modern West is that of the Old Testament, softened by a degree of liberalism, but basically still operating on the basis of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But when we start searching for true freedom, our whole perspective changes. As part of going for refuge, we enter a Sangha, a free association of individuals trying to become free. We try as far as we can to leave behind the world of the Manu, to leave behind the reciprocal relationship. The only law possible among true followers of the path to freedom is the law of loving-kindness. The reciprocal relationship between stimulus and response. Leaving behind the world of the Manu, one gives up the assumptions of mundane life and starts out on the freedom trail. But what is the essential nature of the process by which we are caught up in the mundane life? All the time our five senses are receiving stimuli and our mind is constantly producing a flow of ideas, memories and imaginings. All these stimuli have feelings associated with them, pleasant, painful or neutral. There is no problem with this in itself, but all too often we respond to these feelings automatically. If the stimulus is unpleasant, we react with aversion. We either pull away or go on the offensive. If it is pleasant, we react with craving. We move towards it, literally or metaphorically. Therefore, until we start out on the path to freedom by working on our minds, there will be a close reciprocal relationship between stimulus and response, what we are given and what we give. As with getting cash from a bank's automatic teller, the response will be stereotyped and predictable because it is almost totally conditioned by what is given in the environment. In fact, we can say that the reciprocal relationship is the conditioned relationship. To move on to the path of freedom, however, we have to begin to break this reciprocal relationship between what we receive and what we give. In response to the unpleasant feeling when we are faced with hatred, say, instead of automatically producing hatred, we try to produce loving-kindness, or patience, or equanimity. By doing so, we become increasingly spontaneous and less conditioned by the world. If we keep doing this, we shall eventually arrive at a point on the path to freedom where, however strong the stimulus, even if we are unjustly accused of murder, we no longer play the reciprocal game. Even if we are unfairly criticized or caused pain, it will not occur to us to respond in kind. At that point, we will have broken the chains of the reciprocal relationship and immeasurably widened the sphere of our freedom. Examples of the reciprocal relationship. So far this may have sounded interesting but a little theoretical, so it is time to spell out some of the practical implications. For our quest for freedom to be successful, we need to make two fundamental shifts in attitude. First, we need to give up all thinking based on the reciprocal relationship between what we give and what we receive. And second, a corollary of the first, but so important that it needs to be stated separately, we need to be prepared to give freely without expecting anything in return. Let's go into this in more detail. We'll start by exploring the idea that we have to give up all thinking based on there being a reciprocal relationship between what we give and what we receive. Clearly, to do this will require a very thoroughgoing and radical examination of our attitudes and our habitual modes of thought, because this way of operating is subtle and all-pervasive. Here are a few examples of the kind of thinking I am questioning. I cannot begin to exhaust the possibilities, which are endless. Nobody else does X, so why should I? As in, nobody else washes up after themselves, so why should I? You could imagine one of the Buddhist wanderers in Sarvati who failed to follow the Buddha's advice to be calm and patient. They might lose their temper, justifying it with the thought, "None of these townspeople is treating me with any respect or politeness, so why should I be patient or polite to them?" When you think in that way or make that kind of statement, you, as an individual, are not deciding for yourself what is the right thing to do. You are simply letting what you give be determined by others' lack of giving. This means there will be no consistency to your actions. They are not based on unchanging principles, but are swayed by the vagaries of the actions of those around you. Thus you are, in effect, controlled by your environment and have lost your freedom. I do X, so why don't you? As in, I give up 2 evenings a week to help run this charity, so why can't you? This may be a legitimate statement if you are simply pointing out to someone that you can do something and that there is nothing exceptional about you, so they could do it also. But usually behind, if I do X, why don't you, lurks a kind of tit-for-tat feeling. I am giving this way, so you should feel guilty about not giving in this way too. Again, you could imagine a Buddhist wanderer bursting out in frustration against his critics. I tried to practice kindly speech and to give people the benefit of the doubt, so why can't you? Lurking behind this kind of thinking is often, why can't everyone be more like me? In other words, why can't everyone give in the same way that I give? So again, you are looking for a reciprocal relationship between what you give and what others should give. This is not usually a very productive attitude and fails to see people as individuals. Indeed, expecting others to be like ourselves, when after all they are like themselves, is probably the murky pool in which most of this negative thinking in terms of reciprocal relationships is spawned. I'll give you X if you give me Y. In a way, this statement sums up the classic reciprocal relationship. Many sexual relationships have elements of this kind of trade-off, in which, sadly, sex and affection can become bargaining counters. Both parties are prepared to give only if they are given to, and this inevitably creates tension. The image that for me crystallizes the whole reciprocal relationship in the negative sense is one of those playground scenes where John has taken Errol's calculator and in response Errol has picked up John's mobile phone. What happens next? They are both prepared to give, but only if they get their own items back. So they move cautiously towards each other, each trying to make sure they will receive before they are prepared to let go and give. This tense and suspicious reaching out, being prepared to give but also looking for the opportunity to grab what one wants, symbolizes this whole reciprocal relationship. We find it in personal relationships and all too clearly in politics. This is not to deny that under certain circumstances, if I give a newsagent some money and they give me a newspaper, that is legitimate and useful. But all transactions of that type belong to the world of the Manu, and, as we shall see later, wherever possible, the spiritual aspirant just gives. There are also, by the way, negative versions of I'll give you X if you'll give me Y, as in, if you criticize me, I'll give you so much trouble you'll wish you hadn't bothered. Faced with a threat or some harm to ourselves, we respond with sanctions or violence. Again, simply to turn the other cheek may not be the wisest thing to do. If someone is acting in a bullying and manipulative way, allowing them to achieve their ends simply gives them the message that using power is a successful life strategy. We may need to stand up to people who act in such a way and refuse to give them what they want. However, this should be done out of concern for them and ourselves, not because we have descended to their level and wish to spite them in return for their ill treatment of us. If I am not given X, I won't give you Y. Some people live their whole lives based on this attitude. I wasn't given what I needed as a child, therefore I am not really going to give to anybody until I get what I need. Unfortunately, the God of popular and unsubtle Christianity appears to operate in this way too. If you do not give me your love and devotion for having created you, I am not going to let you into heaven. The wanderers of other sects in our story are not given respect or appreciation, so they will not give any to the Buddha's followers. In fact, they go a stage further, into a very vicious version of, if I am not given X, I'll make sure no one else receives it either. Everyone else does X, so I suppose I shall have to as well. As in, everyone else has agreed to stop eating battery eggs, so I suppose I shall have to as well. Even though your decision may be a good one, in all these examples the issue is one of motivation. In this case, you give up your individuality, your own judgment, because you relate your decision to that of others and feel obliged to do what they do. Perhaps some of the Buddha's newer followers thought it would be better to argue back to the townspeople and only kept quiet or repeated the Buddha's suggested response out of fear that other disciples would criticize them. This sub-individual attitude, in which one goes along with the group out of fear of losing its approval, needs to be carefully distinguished from deferring to others out of respect for their judgment, which can be a very positive motivation. A small example of this negative tendency that I found within myself a few years back was that somebody would write me a letter and sign it, "With much love, so-and-so." When I wrote back to them, I felt I had to respond in kind by putting, "With much love, Vasantara." Eventually, I realized that by doing so, I was being constrained by what the other person wrote, and at times my reciprocal show of affection was dishonest. Naturally, I take into account that people use these expressions in different ways. But these days, if I honestly do not feel so strongly for that person, I reply, "With best wishes, Vasantara." You cannot criticize me for X because you do Y, as in, you cannot criticize me for being late for work because you take such long lunch breaks. A Buddhist wanderer could have rounded upon the Sarvati householders saying, "How dare you criticize me for being a hypocrite when you aren't making any effort yourself and are just immersed in worldly life?" You can imagine how well that would have gone down. This kind of reciprocal thinking causes more trouble in social situations, even between people practicing the Dharma together, than almost any other. If someone does give you some criticism, it never helps to criticize them back. If you do so, the situation becomes one of futile tit-for-tat. If you are going to criticize me, I'm going to list my grievances about you. If you respond with criticism, you usually spark off an escalating series of recriminations. If someone criticizes you, even if you know that their behavior is more open to criticism than yours, you should consider what they say on its merits and accept it if it is true. On a separate occasion, you may gently point out that they also sometimes act in unhelpful ways. Tying the two together into a reciprocal relationship always causes trouble and bad feeling. I'd better not say anything to them about X, because they might criticize me for Y. This is the other side of the coin, as in, I won't criticize him for going out drinking, in case he criticizes me for being extravagant with money. You often find more than one person in a situation thinking in this way. Two or more people may collude together, tacitly agreeing not to notice each other's unhelpful behavior, so that they can all carry on doing what they like. If you come upon a situation among Dharma practitioners that feels rather dead, where there is not much energy moving, then you can suspect that people have sunk into this kind of collusive reciprocal relationship, where they are not going to raise issues with one another for fear of being questioned themselves. I could carry on multiplying examples, but I trust I have said enough to make clear what I mean here by a reciprocal relationship in the negative sense. The reciprocal relationship is the conditioned relationship where what you give and take is governed by what others are giving and taking. It is the tit for tat, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours relationship. It is the mode of thinking that underlies all the principles of mundane life, and it is deeply ingrained in all of us. In every example I have given, the thinking is based on gross or subtle forms of relating in terms of power. One of our tasks, having embarked on the path to freedom, is to dump all this baggage of thinking in reciprocal terms, constantly making some kind of tie-up between giving and receiving. In order to become free individuals, we need to break out of the reciprocal relationship and all other ways in which we relate to others, crudely or subtly, in terms of power. Give what you can, take what you need. Now it is time to look at the second fundamental shift in attitude I mentioned. This, we saw, is the corollary of giving up thinking in reciprocal terms, that we need to be prepared to give freely without expecting anything in return. From a Buddhist point of view, even the Marxist slogan, give what you can, take what you need, is not radical enough. Probably the ideal motto for a Buddhist Sangha would be, give what you can, full stop. But perhaps that is not very realistic, so I'd better propose, give what you can, ask for whatever you need in order to enable you to continue to give. That would be an acceptable reciprocal relationship, if we can call it that, between giving and receiving. This was the position of the Buddha and his immediate disciples. The Buddha does not seem to have expected to be fed. He did not remind people as he went on his arms round that he had taught so much Dharma and given so much to the world that he was entitled to be supported. He simply poured out the Dharma like golden rain on all people equally and went silently from house to house with his alms bowl. And if some days he did not get what he needed and he went hungry, he did not complain. So when you start out on the Buddhist path to freedom, you aspire to give freely to the world with no strings attached. Ideally, all you hope for from the world is that it will enable you to satisfy your basic material needs so that you will be able to continue to help it. In taking this approach to life, you will be very much out of step with surrounding society. The language of rights and entitlements is everywhere these days. On its own level, in the world of the Manu, this is reasonable enough. I am not denying that there are certain rights with which a society ought to endow its citizens, such as the right to a fair trial, and which should be campaigned for if necessary. Although many people these days seem much keener on demanding their rights than on fulfilling their responsibilities as citizens. However, when you move from the world of the Manu to the world of the Buddha and start looking at your existential situation from that wider perspective, you see that the universe confers no rights on sentient beings and knows nothing of their entitlements. You recognize that you can never completely rely on having your needs met, because that would be to expect mundane life, samsara in Pali, to give you what you want. By its nature, samsara is bound to be unreliable in satisfying your needs. The only contract that samsara guarantees to fulfill is to provide a continuous experience of what Buddhism calls the three marks, which are characteristics of all mundane experience: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and lack of inherent existence. It will fulfil that contract perfectly. The person committed to true freedom sees this clearly, which is why they go forth from samsara, to use traditional terminology. Going forth means no longer expecting the mundane to satisfy your needs. Seeing this, the person who has gone forth, who has gone for refuge, looks only to the three jewels to satisfy them. Of course, this does not mean that if you have gone for refuge and need a pair of shoes, you may not go to a shoe shop. It means that you no longer finally rely on anything but the three jewels. You see everything else as unreliable. So you are not surprised or disappointed when the shop is closed or nothing fits. After all, that is samsara. I think it is worth reflecting on how often we expect samsara to give us what we need and are disappointed, even though we know that everything changes so that nothing mundane is 100% reliable. In all aspects of life, things will go wrong, and our needs will not be met. Whilst we cannot rely on mundane affairs to go right for us, we can at least try to be a source of steady kindness and confidence for the world. Through practicing the precepts, we can become an increasingly trustworthy force for good for those with whom we come into contact. Because we are committed to embodying the values of kindness, generosity, contentment, truthfulness, and awareness, people will trust us not to use power or manipulation. For us, following the precepts will gradually break the reciprocal relationship between what we give to the world and what we expect from it. Even if others are causing harm or using power to get their way, we don't join in. Whether or not others are grabbing what they can, we try to keep a generous attitude. Even if others are being manipulative to get their own way sexually, we don't play those games. Even if others are lying and swearing that black is white and all the other colours of the rainbow, we try to hold to the truth. Even if everyone else is drowning their sorrows, we work to keep awake and aware. None of this is done in a holier-than-thou way. That would be just another subtle form of reciprocal thinking, by which we indirectly reinforced our position in relation to others. Ideally, we practice kindness, generosity, contentment, truthfulness, and mindfulness because we believe in them, because they bring us happiness, and because they are a gift to the world. Gratitude and keeping score. In describing the dangers of thinking in terms of a reciprocal relationship between what you are prepared to give and the actions of others, I am not denying the importance of gratitude. It is a beautiful and important quality. On the path to freedom, generosity sparks off more generosity. This is a natural process between people whose hearts are open. It has nothing to do with keeping the account square. Between two people on that rainbow way, generosity as an expression of openness sparks off more openness, but nobody keeps score. Gratitude is a spiritual quality, whereas what I call keeping score is part of the negative reciprocal relationship in the world of the Manu. Put simply, when someone gives you something to you, there are two possible responses. You can keep your heart closed to them and keep score, in which case you feel in debt to that person. You may even feel subtly guilty or resentful that they have made you indebted to them. Or, not wishing to be put under an obligation to them, you quickly forget or dismiss their generosity to you, which means your heart is not affected by their kindness or their love for you. All this is the reciprocal relationship. Alternatively, when someone opens themselves to you and gives, you can open your heart in response. Their giving, taken into your heart, gives birth to gratitude and sparks off further gratitude and further giving. And this process can carry on indefinitely between the two of you, or even more than two of you, in which case a spiral dance can begin, a soaring dance, like eagles circling and leading one another higher and higher into the sky. I am aware, painfully so at times, that it is hard to live up to this ideal. As people still on the early stages of the path to freedom, this gratitude and spontaneous generosity may not come naturally to us. We shall find it hard to give to people and expect nothing back, harder still at times when we receive nothing back. We shall have to work at it as a practice. It will be difficult for us to do until we arrive at the point that Gotami came to of stream entry. Even then there will be a resistance. However, as we continue along the transcendental path, we shall eventually reach a point where, although our lives have become an outpouring of generosity, we shall give with no sense of there being a giver, a receiver, or a gift. This is what the Buddhist texts concerning perfection of wisdom tell us. Hence, there will be no sense of a reciprocal relationship between a giver and a receiver. Perhaps, as long as we feel ourselves to be a fixed subject giving to an object, however refined that feeling may be, there will always be some element of reciprocity, a subtle desire for the object to give us some return on our giving. Though it may be difficult for us to break the reciprocal relationship and give freely and unconditionally, it is at least good to be clear that that is the ideal at which we are aiming. That is where the path to freedom leads. We can at least make a start by trying to give without feeling that we are putting the other person under any obligation to us, and to receive without feeling a guilty obligation to give back, or, if we are not in position to reciprocate, not allowing ourselves fully to receive what has been given to us. We can also try to become more conscious of our tendency to think in terms of tit for tat. If I give this, you should give that. If I do not give this, then... Or, if they do not give this, then I will not give that, and so on, tying together our giving and receiving with that of other people. We can work to catch ourselves thinking in this way, rationalizing or justifying our actions in terms of a reciprocal relationship between what we should give and what we are entitled to receive. When we see these patterns of thought in ourselves, we can take the initiative by giving, by going out to people. In this way, we shall initiate positive changes in the situations and relationships in which we are involved. The points I have been making are seen most clearly in the arena of friendship. Some people see the process of making friendships as a reciprocal relationship. They wait for someone to be a friend to them, at which point they are prepared to give friendship in return. If nobody makes friendly overtures to them, they complain that they have no friends. When you step beyond the reciprocal relationship, you start to go out yourself, initiating the process of being a friend to people. When you do this, you will soon find you have plenty of friends. Levels of giving. We have come a long way in this chapter. We could also look at the ground we have covered from another angle by identifying three levels of giving. The level of the mundane, of the manu, before we set out on the path to freedom. The level of the path up to stream entry. And then the transcendental level. In the world of the manu, you always give because, and that because springs from a conditioned relationship between subject and object. What you give is decided by what you have been given, or what you hope or expect to receive. Once you venture onto the lower stages of the path to freedom, you try as far as possible just to give. It is still giving because, but at least it is because you are moved by an ideal, by the promptings of loving kindness, by an intuition of freedom, rather than because you have to, because you are in a reciprocal relationship with the object. Finally, we come to the level of stream entry and beyond, where you are in touch with the true nature of things. Increasingly, as you follow the transcendental path, there is less idea of giving or receiving. Someone who has reached this level does not give because, or if there is a because attached to their giving, then the person who is far advanced on the path will tell you that they give because beings suffer and someone has to help, or that they give because an act of giving, freely carried out, expecting nothing, is the most beautiful and satisfying act in the universe. Finally, however, they give for no reason, because giving has become as natural to them as breathing. The example of the tortured wanderer. Sundari's sad death and the ensuing events at Sarvati have provoked a number of reflections. They have pointed out the need to avoid conditioned relationships based on a reciprocal relationship between how we are treated by the world and how we treat it. They have warned us to be on the lookout for all the ways of thinking that we may have carried onto the path based on that type of relationship. They have highlighted the fact that on the path to freedom, we need to cease relying on, having unrealistic expectations of, the mundane. And they have shown us the beauty of an attitude based on free giving. Having seen all this, let's return to our starting point, to patience and forbearance, for we need to take one further step if we are to understand the full meaning of the story. In his verse, the Buddha speaks only of bearing abuse unperturbed at heart. Patience in Buddhism is often compared to armour which wards off attack. This can convey an impression of this quality as a kind of long-suffering endurance. However, good though this kind of passive forbearance may be, there is only limited freedom in simply remaining inactive, like a tortoise inside its shell. The patience we are looking for to develop is not stolid indifference, but a dynamic force powered by loving-kindness. Much Buddhist practice, in meditation and in other ways, is devoted to fanning the flames of loving-kindness for all living beings. The energy of this loving-kindness eventually becomes so strong that it overpowers any negative responses we might have to unpleasant people and situations. When we respond with loving-kindness, regardless of how others treat us, then we shall have broken the chains of the reciprocal relationship forever. From the Buddhist point of view, patience and loving-kindness are not just to be applied in the face of criticism or abuse, but even in the face of violence. In one of his teachings to a man called Moliya Paguna, the Buddha asks his hearers to imagine that one of his male wandering followers had been caught by bandits. These bandits take hold of him and tie him down. They then bring a two-handed saw and start to saw him limb from limb. Now, says the Buddha, if that wanderer, as he was being hewn into pieces, should harbour any thoughts of ill will against his tormentors, he would not be acting as my disciple, he would not be following my teaching. If we bring the example up to date and imagine someone being tortured by the agents of a repressive regime, we begin to feel the force of the statement the Buddha is making and its universal applicability. That even if you are being tortured through no fault of your own, and if you harbour any feeling of ill will towards those who are harming you, you are not following the Dharma, not moving towards freedom. This is a very demanding ideal indeed. However, there are present-day examples of some Tibetan monks and nuns ill-treated by the Chinese who managed to hold to the Buddha's teaching. They suffered great physical pain and privation, but bore it all with peaceful hearts. Such people are freer than their jailers and torturers. They have gone beyond thoughts of a reciprocal relationship between themselves and the world. They give loving kindness to their tormentors, regardless of the pain they are inflicting. Perhaps there often passes through the minds of such people one of the first pieces of the Buddhist teaching they ever heard. It is a simple verse which, if we can allow its implications to permeate our being, will begin to dissolve away all thoughts of their reciprocal relationship. It runs, "Hatred does not cease by hatred. Hatred ceases only by love."